Hey, podcasters, welcome to another edition of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Master Doll, and today's program we still have, still with us, hasn't left, hasn't skedaddled, the special guest co-host, Jill Simonello. Hey, Jill, how are you doing today?
Hello, I am doing well. Beautiful day in Chicago, so no complaints here.
Oh, that's something in the springtime. It's always hit or miss there in Chicago.
Yes, it is.
So before we get too far, I printed this off again to remind myself to thank our sponsors, HIDExtra.com. The episode is brought to you by our friends over there. Go to HIDExtra.com to view the best in HID and LED headlight conversion kits and accessories for your truck or SUV. These are the LED light bars and HID, the bulbs that go inside your headlights. While you're there, use code PPT15 to get your 15% off your lighting order today. In the show notes, I'll have the link to HIDExtra.com. Check it out. Use the promo code. We're tracking that. Yes, we are tracking that. So we want to make sure you're using that and it's beneficial to you. So there you go. Go get some lights. Enliven your life with lights. On today's show, we have four impressive topics to talk about. Actually, they really are. The first one I want to get to is a hydrogen semi. Then we have a Honda CR-V hybrid. Jill, with the capital J journalist, has a special AAA story she found. We're going to talk with Matt Gunn in the interview segment of the show. Matt Gunn is with Supplier Radio. It's a very interesting discussion. It's a Supplier Talk Radio podcast. He talks to suppliers. We're talking part suppliers of automotive products and how they're adapting to the changing needs of the automotive segment, and some cool customization coming down the line. One thing you want to listen for is at the end of that interview, we're talking about Adidas shoes that you can special order with your name on them.
I want Adidas shoes with my name on them.
It's kind of a crazy thing. It's something that I, you know, learned with a special guest. So a very interesting interview, and I'll wrap it up. I just got dropped off yesterday a Dodge Durango Citadel. I want to talk a little more about that. It's a very interesting how they have that in the product segment of Dodge Durango products. But first, let's go back to the hydrogen semi. Yes, Toyota, the Mirai, which is their hydrogen fuel cell car, made big news this week when they showed off a hydrogen semi. And what it does is it's got a 12 kilowatt battery. It's got two Mirai fuel cells, and it's got a motor. And what that's going to do is fill up the fuel cells with hydrogen, and you're going to run off that. That's going to be your power source. A couple interesting pieces about this is it's going to be in Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Long Beach. Those are two of the busiest ports in the world, and they're the most polluted ports in the world because of the diesel fuel there is naturally polluting. And with California along the coast there, it just traps the smog, and it creates some poor air quality. And so if they clean up the air quality in that port, it would go a long ways to improving the air quality. And it's not just the ports, and it's not just like a fictitious thing. They've really spent a lot of time working on this. This truck has 670 horsepower, 1,325 pound-feet of torque. It is a Class 8 semi. It has a gross vehicle combined capacity of 80,000 pounds. So it can haul some cargo, and it's 200 miles of range, which I thought was pretty impressive for that kind of a vehicle. 30 to 40 minutes, though, that is the refilling time at the moment to refill the vehicle with hydrogen, to fill up the tanks. But it emits water. It spits out water in the back end. That's what it does. And so it's interesting. Some of the people there, some of the companies, I read a few articles on this, had said that they had tried electric vehicles before. They had tried diesel electric. They've tried different hybrids. And the challenge for them has been that in the real world application, it doesn't really work. It just doesn't work for the workflow. They need more power. They need longer longevity. So you're talking 200 miles. So they could literally pick up stuff from the docks, drive back and forth to some shipping depots all day on, I would imagine, a tank of gas, because I don't know how long they would drive, or they may drive to a depot and fill up there. The 30 to 40 minute fueling time would be a concern, I would think. But that's going to change as technology changes, as it get improved in how that distributed. Infrastructure is still going to be an issue, so they're not going to be long-term shipping. You can't ship across the U.S. because you don't have the hydrogen fuel cells across the country to fuel up with. So a very interesting development. It's got lots of repercussions in that if you can get a semi-truck to run on hydrogen, you can get a pickup truck to ride on hydrogen. you can get vans, you can get SUVs, you can get anything running on hydrogen. I want to say that I read a Green Car Reports quite a while ago that talked about the cost of hydrogen per, I don't even know how they're going to measure it, maybe per gallon, they may do equivalent for that. And I believe it was considerably cheaper than a gallon of gas, and there wasn't as much fluctuation because of the way hydrogen is developed. So a very interesting thing. It's happening right now. It's a prototype. It's project. It's going to take place for the next several months, and they will see what they learn from it, see what they can improve, see what they want to move forward with it. You're talking about shots fired at Cummins. I mean, really, right? Shots fired at the different engine manufacturers, like we had Acadis Power on the 2 months ago. They're developing a new gasoline engine. Those are great, but if you're going to build a hydrogen one that has runs better and emits water and can cost less to fuel up, those are going to be a detriment of those kind of products. So I thought it was a very interesting story, Jill. Did you find it as interesting as I did?
I've always thought that fuel cells and hydrogen is the way forward. I like the idea of an electric car, but to me, hydrogen is, I just think it's the better way because of the environment, the overall toll it takes. I mean, the primary problem is, okay, how do you get hydrogen? And is it dirty making hydrogen? But then once you establish how you can make hydrogen cleanly, it's about building the infrastructure. But I had, gosh, it's probably been about 10 years ago now, where Chevrolet was experimenting with the Equinox, and they'd put fuel cells in the Equinox. And it was one of those things, and it was before the electric cars were really, out. I don't think Tesla existed yet. And it was just fascinating to me because you get this instantaneous torque like an electric car, and it drives like a gasoline powered vehicle. And to me, I mean, especially if you can build up the infrastructure, there's just no range anxiety. There is, there's just nothing that you need to worry about with hydrogen. So, I mean, if they could make that work for a semi truck, and I think that's fascinating, and we could all use a little less pollution in our lives.
Well, and it seems to me too that we're conditioned to go into the gas station to get fuel. We know this. That's what we're doing. And we do the same conditioning to go to hydrogen in the gas station. It's not that big of a leap. I would also imagine they could probably put hydrogen in a similar gas can apparatus that you could carry with you. If you ran out of fuel, you could put that in the back of the Jeep as well. They could figure something out with that. But EVs have always been, it's special. It's different. It's unique. You got to learn how to work with them. But hydrogen is. We're conditioned to be with hydrogen better. I think it'd be an easier insertion in our lifestyle to say, okay, well, there's regular diesel and hydrogen. There's your choices, right? And so I think there's some real applications of this. And I think it's exciting they started with semis because, like you said, if you can't prove it with semis, then you can't prove anything. I mean, it's just that's where you want to go. And speaking of semis, you had something about Tesla.
So speaking of semis, and Elon Musk has been tweeting again, and he put out a tweet last week basically saying that the Tesla semi and a Tesla pickup truck are coming within 2 years.
Right. And so
If we believe it.
right. I think Elon is a very, very smart guy. I really do. However, I would challenge him on his real world application on thinking how things work. Seems like sometimes that's not always thought through the full extent. And he makes big promises, but he should. I mean, he's got shareholders that he wants to impress, and he's got to make grandiose statements. It'd be interesting to see Tesla's version of that. Nikolai, I just thought of this too. Nikolai put out a Class 8 electric vehicle, electric semi truck as well. But like you, I think hydrogen's the way to go. I think EV, the challenge with EV to me quite often, honestly, is when you get up in the windy conditions of the mountains or you get in the snowy passes of Montana, electric batteries tend to drain faster. And you're gonna put a lot of load on those batteries, and then you're gonna trust they're gonna hold their charge. you know, we all have Duracell batteries. Some of them last longer than other ones. Sometimes they just don't last at all. And so I know it's not, that's not a direct, you know, it doesn't directly apply, but still, I think hydrogen, though, if you can sell you're running low, you can pull over and get more hydrogen. I think that, you know, keep you on the road, keep going. So exciting development. There is on our Facebook page, and you need to check this out. You need to go check it out. Pickup Truck Talk, Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk on the Facebook page. Sorry, I made the change, updated it. There is a video that my friends at Toyota shot. It shows an off-the-line speed of a diesel-powered semi-truck versus the hydrogen fuel cell semi-truck. And I got to tell you, it looks like the damn diesel standing still.
Yeah, I'm telling you, instantaneous torque. Instantaneous torque.
And in a semi. I theorize that it's going to improve our traffic, you know, congestion. It's going to improve the traffic congestion because instead of, you know, I've gone through Colorado numerous times. I used to live in Denver. And you get up in the mountains in Colorado in wintertime, and semis are struggling to get to the top of the hills. They're struggling off the line. They're struggling. If you give it instantaneous torque to pull that load up over the mountain, you're going to improve traffic times throughout the mountains. It's going to make skiing a lot better, you know, because you get up there actually in a decent amount of time. Anyways, I could go on about this. I'm excited. I have friends with Toyota, and I'm actively nudging them. I want to come check it out. Toyota friends. I want to come check it out. I want to see what it's all about. I want to see... learn more about it. I haven't done a good job as a journalist. I have failed as a journalist to know much about hydrogen because it hasn't really been applicable. But now it is. So, hey. Moving on. We'll finally move on. The Shanghai Auto Show is going on right now. Shanghai is the China Auto Show. It's one of the largest auto shows in the world. It's an interesting show in that the vehicles are usually European vehicle specs or Asia vehicle specs. They're not really U.S. vehicle specs. However, there are a few vehicles that come out of the Shanghai show that do make their way into the U.S. marketplace. Just because of timing, sometimes automakers put them over there, they show them over there, and they bring them to the U.S. Ford's done this. Different manufacturers do this. Honda did this. Honda did this with a CR-V. So the CR-V is the, my goodness, the best-selling SUV in the planet. I mean, everybody's got a CR-V story like everybody's got a Camry story. And they've offered a hybrid powertrain to the CR-V. And the exciting part with that is that the hybrid powertrain is expected to have a, it's supposed to use kind of like a Accord's hybrid drive system. It's a lithium ion battery pack, electric motor, and 2.0 liter i4 together for a total output of 212 horsepower, at least as much torque. Now that's Green Car Reports. Green Car Reports is one of the, our industry's big green car outlets and some of the most respected, I would say, journalists work over there. It's branded as Honda Sports Hybrid iMMD. That's the name of the CR-V's propulsion system. So we don't have any numbers on it. It suggests the improvements will improve over performance and efficiency over the current crossover's 1.5 liter turbocharged four cylinder. I wanted to get, there's some mile per gallon expectations. So the Accord Hybrid is a car, right? So you can't measure them exactly, but they're about $200 different between that and the SUV. Truck Trend is saying they'd expect fuel economy to take a slight dip from the Accord to around 38 mile per gallon in combined driving. 38 mile per gallon is huge when you consider the Toyota RAV4 hybrid, similar size vehicle, gets 32 mile per gallon, and a Nissan Rogue hybrid gets 34 mile per gallon. So 6 better over the Toyota and 4 better than Nissan. Those are big numbers. Those are big numbers for similar vehicles. So I'm excited to see if they'll bring the CR-V over here. Now, Honda has said that they don't expect it to be a U.S. market CR-V hybrid, which is just nuts, right? It's just nuts not to have a hybrid in the U.S. Is there something I'm missing here, Jill?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, if you have been looking at the news coming out of the Shanghai show, it's all about electric cars or, you know, green cars, hybrid cars. And, you know, the sense that I'm getting is that China is making a big, big, big push towards electrification. And, you know, I mean, they're taking, General Motors revealed that they're taking the Chevrolet Volt and they're turning it into the Buick V-Lite. Yep. 5. And so it's just like things like that where you're seeing a lot of electric news coming out of the show. And I just really think that China in general is making a huge push towards electrification, whereas frankly, the United States is not.
Well, and China's got the leftover lingerings from the what they do, the Olympics, where Beijing was covered in a smog of smoke, and the runners were concerned about actually running at that and that and all the pollution. I mean, they had some big hangover from that. They actually, when Ford is going to bring the Raptor over there, and they're going to bring the Ranger over there, and different trucks, and there's still a long-standing law in some provinces of China. You can't drive a truck between during daylight hours because it's just too much emission. You only drive it overnight is what they're, because they have a big smog problem. It's like I've said it many times to my friends. I'm like, that damn EPA, they do all the stuff. Well, sometimes they're good. Sometimes we all have cleaner air because of them. They agreeably they overstep their bounds at certain places. It gets a little irritating, but the big picture, well, we do all right with air quality here versus other parts of the country, so or parts of the world. So I think they'll bring it over here at some point. It makes sense. It fits in a lineup. It would be probably announcement at the Los Angeles show in November would be probably the next feasible time Honda would actually make a big announcement like that, because I think it'd be a huge item. And you're having two big competitors, Toyota and Nissan, with a hybrid SUV in the marketplace. Makes you believe they would might want to be competitive with those as well. So that's what I had, and those were fascinating stories. You have to agree, fascinating stories. So what did you have?
I just and it only is peripherally related to truck stuff, but it was just enough to kind of catch my eye, and it was enough. I wrote a story about it just because I thought it was interesting. AAA released a study this week, basically saying that in a truck world, people are still interested in electric vehicles. So we're continuing the electrification theme from China, I guess. I don't know. But people basically said, and I'm probably like way oversimplifying this, but people are as interested in buying an EV as they are in buying a truck. Now, whether that means they follow through with buying the EV versus buying a truck, I don't know, considering that something like 60% of vehicle sales last month were trucks. I don't ever imagine we'll get to a point, well, at least not anytime soon, where we'll get to a point where 60% of vehicles sold are EVs. But, I just thought it was really interesting that, even though gas prices are down and people are buying a lot of larger vehicles, that people are still asking questions and still interested in the electric cars or the plug-in electric cars. So.
That is interesting because historically, so far, EV and plug-in electric cars have constituted a very small amount of the monthly sales or actually yearly sales of any automaker. I mean, you're talking single digits, right? So I thought it was really funny with the Bolt when the Bolt came out, which is a compact car, 200 miles per gallon, 200 mile fill up, whatever range, fully electric. Chevy made an enormous deal about this Bolt. And I'm rolling my eyes over here because I don't really care. We actually have a joke. I have a joke with the Chevy team that they can't bring me a Bolt because it won't make it. It's 192. It's 192 miles from here to Denver, and there's a lot of highway speeds and it goes uphill and a lot of wind. And I've said it won't make it. So we have an ongoing joke about that, the Bolt. But they made such a big deal about that, and then you look at overall sales, and overall sales, it's still in the hundreds. I mean, I don't think they're gonna. I can see its application in certain parts of the country. Yes, I can see people buying it, but it's we make a big deal about this new technology, and then people still go out and buy a Tahoe. They'll still go out buy, an F-150. And even though we're sitting there talking about EVs and plug-in hybrids and hydrogen fuel cells, those are still such a small niche part of the marketplace.
They are. And so first with the Bolt though, it's only being sold in California, so you've got to take the sales with a grain of salt. I think that's only California and Oregon right now. They're getting
Oh
ready to
no. My friend sent me photos. He bought one in outside of Boston.
because they're not for sale in Chicago or Illinois yet. So I think they started on,
Right, so they're rolling it
so they
out, sure.
started in California and Oregon and Washington, and then I think they moved it over to the East Coast. Where, as they typically do, is phase two and then phase three. I think I read again on our friends, the Green Car Report, on their website, John Volker, who is the primary writer there, he actually did a timeline of the rollout. And I want to say it's not scheduled to roll out, to the rest of the country until like the middle of the summer.
Sure. So I'll take the criticism. I will. I'll take that.
Number one.
I would also argue that that number still, by the time the rollout's going to come out, it's not going to be anywhere near.
No,
It's
no.
just not.
Well, and my problem with it too is, and this is all electric vehicles, whether they're SUVs or cars, the infrastructure isn't there yet. And so, the interesting thing is, like, I think the Bolt is a great idea. It's 238 miles of range, but you're right, it's probably not going to be able to make it from Denver to your house. Well, mostly though, because there probably isn't a charging station halfway between where they could go and plug in for a half an hour and get a cup of coffee and then finish the way. So similarly, like, I live in Chicago, I could not drive a Bolt to Detroit. I could not drive a Bolt to Indianapolis because I've looked on, I want to say it's called plugshare.com or whatever, but there's websites out there that will show you where the charging stations are between point A and point B, and there is nothing between Chicago and Indianapolis or Chicago and Detroit. So until they build that infrastructure, there is no way electric cars can really take off, period. And I asked General Motors, I said, well, you're really making this push on this, electric vehicle. Are you going to help build the infrastructure? And they said, no. We're not going to help build the infrastructure because we're building a great car. Somebody else should, because we're building a great car, somebody else should want to build the infrastructure. And I was like, well, that's not always how it goes. And so Tesla, I think, has done a really interesting thing because, they want people to make Tesla their only car. And so they've really put in a lot of effort to make supercharger stations, at strategic locations. So, like, if I had a Tesla, I could drive a Tesla to Detroit. I could drive a Tesla to Indianapolis, but I could not drive any other electric vehicle to those places from Chicago.
Are you okay though with the thought of pulling over and letting it charge while you get a cup of coffee? Are we okay making it a journey again? 'Cause a lot of times I do cross country stuff and it's like it's gonna take me 8 hours to get there, and I'll be damned, I'm gonna get there in 8 hours and 2 minutes because I'm gonna pee real fast and just drive my heart out, to get there, right? Because I know it's not on time. But if you're talking 8 hours in a Tesla, you're gonna be like, okay, I'm gonna drive four, I'm gonna stop and charge for half an hour, I'm gonna charge. Are we conditioned to get to being that's okay?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that because it's funny. Offline we were talking a little bit about working out, and I used to go to the gym like every day for 2 hours, but now I'm like, I just don't have the time to do that. I've got stuff to do, man. I gotta get in, I gotta get out, I gotta, I like, if I've got an hour to spend at the gym, like, that's way too much time. So I don't know. I don't know if we are conditioned. Like, I feel like we are very programmed to jump from one thing to the next. So do we have that half an hour to go and spend and drink coffee? That's an interesting question. Because, I'm like you. I'm driving to go visit my sister who lives in Indianapolis. It's a 3 hour drive. And, if I could get there in 2 hours and 59 minutes, like, that would be awesome.
Because we want to get there. So I don't, it's an interesting thing. I would challenge a AAA study a little bit. I think people are interested in it because they don't know about it, and I think they know about trucks. I mean, you talk to the average guy, he knows. The average guy or woman also, they have a general idea about trucks. They just do. And so I don't know. It's an interesting study. Very interesting study. So we should move along before this becomes like 4 hours of talking about EVs and whether we got to pee real fast to get across the country. up next is my friend, my old college friend. Actually, we went to college together at Metro State there in Denver. He's going to talk to you about suppliers and part suppliers. Very interesting conversation. Stick to it, and we'll be right back. After that, we'll talk about the Dodge Durango. And welcome back to more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. I'm your host, Master Doll. On today's program, we have a very special guest. It's going to be a little bit different than our typical podcast guest because he's a little bit outside of the realm of automotive, even though he does talk about it. I'll explain in a minute. It's going to be a little confusing, but I want to welcome Matt Gunn to the program. He's the host of Supply Chain Radio. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, thanks, Tim. And very special. Might be overselling it a little bit, but thanks.
Everybody's special to me, Matt.
Well,
A quick
that's
note for those: Matt and I went to college together at Metro State, so we have a long history of knowing each other, for better or worse. And I invited him on the program. We've been talking for a while offline about doing a podcast because he has experience doing his own, and he covers a very interesting piece of the marketplace you don't hear a lot about, which is suppliers and how the suppliers get the parts to market and how they're going to customize parts. And there's a whole animal there. And I wrote a story a while ago talking about Toyota. For those in the automotive world that know this, is that Toyota holds their suppliers and parts suppliers to a very stringent setting as far as what they can manufacture parts to, the quality of them. Very stringent quality standards. More so than, say, Chevy, more so than Ford, more so than, say, Ram. And so the question I had for a while was, does it matter, what matters more? Are the parts more important in the supply chain? Is the quality of parts more important than the finalized product that the company's building? So, you know, when you buy a Toyota truck, car, SUV, whatever, you're buying basically a collection of parts that are done through parts and suppliers coming in. And there's a lot of times they're doing a lot more just-in-time production at plants because they're bringing the part suppliers on site, and then they're basically walking the product over the floor, and it allows them to build at much quicker pace. And so I'm just curious to talk with Matt Gunn today about this topic. They do some automotive work in the supply chain radio. I've listened to a few podcasts. It's very interesting viewpoints they have as far as automotive and the supply chain. So, you know, as we move forward, technology moving forward, what do you see in your segment? Are we getting better with suppliers bringing parts to the marketplace? Is the customization better? What's going on in that segment?
I think there's a lot of things, Tim. When you talk about parts and what makes a car, so much of what's in a vehicle today comes from someone else. It's not Toyota manufacturing every piece of that truck, but an entire ecosystem of suppliers that are working very closely with the manufacturer to build the right pieces for the right vehicle and make sure that they're there at the right time so that those vehicles can get made and shipped. But parts matter. I mean, just look back at the Takata airbag recall.
Good example.
A couple of years ago, right? Mm-hmm. It took a lot of forensics to figure out what was wrong with that. Meanwhile, Toyota's the one whose reputation is getting bashed. When you think about it, you know, there's that old line that you can outsource a lot of your manufacturing processes, but you can't outsource risk. At the end of the day, what the customer sees is a Toyota truck, for instance. And when you hear news reports or see massive recalls, I think it was like 2.9 million Toyotas that were recalled as a result of this faulty part, this faulty airbag, that really does damage your reputation. And you as the manufacturer do have to take that into consideration, not only just from the aspect of, you know, the damage that happens from what customers think about you, but the monetary costs of now having to replace that part with something that's not faulty, maybe finding an entirely new supplier to provide that airbag, and then bringing back those vehicles into your dealerships or into authorized mechanics and having it replaced. So, yeah, I think that in the world of automobiles, that has become more important and more necessary than ever. It used to be that the parts manufacturers were all co-located near the factories. Well, the factories have changed. They're in various places all across the world, and those parts manufacturers, those are too. So not only do you have to consider quality, but you have to consider how you're getting those parts to the factories and then getting that finished vehicle out to the market.
And what are suppliers doing these days, technology, to get that stuff to the marketplace faster? Is there software? Are there new software techniques? Is there new development processes? You know, it used to be just put it on UPS and ship it over. Are there changes there as well?
Yeah, I think there are. It depends on who you are. If you're the manufacturer, you have had processes in place and you're pretty well tied in with your suppliers. But every new platform that you're building is going to invariably have some changes. And so you have to service it one way or another. Because of that changing nature of where parts are made and the distribution of factories, customer base, there has been a big movement to not only make sure that those things are getting to you, but that all of the movements are being done efficiently and with as much visibility as possible. If you're planning to build 3,000 cars, you have to be able to ensure that all of the parts for those 3,000 cars are there when you're set to start your manufacturing run. How do you do that? Well, sometimes you can plan it out, and that's great. But even the best planning is subject to so many factors that are outside of your control. And where manufacturers are trying to get better, especially as they run lean and try to hold less inventory for less amounts of time, what they're really looking for is repeatability and agility for when something goes wrong. So another, not to keep harping on Toyota problems that they've had in the past, but there was a factory fire last year, and it was one of the main plants that supplied steel to Toyota for its vehicles. How do you work around that? And so that's something that these car companies are trying to get better at planning for and considering, where, say, that plant goes down or that supplier goes down, who's next in line? And how are you going to then plan around different logistics challenges to make sure that those parts still get to you when you're ready to start that manufacturing run, so that you're not sitting on inventory or so that you're not losing factory days that were planned out well in advance, and so that you can get those new cars out to the market when and where you need them to go.
And that's very true. I think something that consumers don't understand, like Takata or like the steel fires, there's not like 15 different airbag companies. There's not a bunch of different steel manufacturers. There's only a couple. And so as parts suppliers have consolidated and got bigger and consolidated and got bigger, you have less variety. And so you can't build back as like a backlog of suppliers to come in, because, and also the cars have gotten more technical and how they're being built. So the parts are very specific. I do want to talk to you to get a little bit about supply chain, to look just a touch political, just a very touch political. There's been a lot of talk about some border taxing going on between Mexico and the U.S. And I know you're a news junkie. You follow along. I've been following along with this. It's a huge deal with automotive right now because manufacturers are screaming, holy hell, it's going to raise prices of cars because all the part suppliers in Mexico will have to move to the U.S. and back and forth. That disruption in supply chain, is that a topic of conversation with you guys? Are your suppliers talking about that? Are you having discussions about it?
Yeah, that's a tough one, and it is touchy. And while software is not going to change the political machinations of any one administration or what's going on in other countries where parts are being supplied, one thing that it is pushing companies to do is to get smarter about the trade lanes that they use and make the most of the situation. Within supply chain, I think really everything that you do is very much in the moment. You're constantly responding to change, new pressure. There's always something that you have to deliver. When it comes to things like, say, a border-adjusted tax and the automotive industry in particular, that's going to be a real challenge. If the intention is to get rid of trade deficits, I think that, you know, that's can be a very noble thing.
Yes.
But with the way that things are being manufactured and the way that we've moved as a culture in terms of how we build or where we build products, it will cause new friction. That 20% tax, now consider, say, a car seat. You might not think about it, but that might cross the border two or three times, or the parts within that car seat might cross the border multiple times. How does that end up getting taxed, or what kind of contingencies do you have to build in to make sure that you're sourcing somewhere to at least reduce the amount of extra cost that that's going to have, that will occur as a result? And those are the types of things that we're hearing people starting to think about now. Now, at the end of the day, you know, and we've done some surveys on this, and particularly in the world of retail, where very much, or the fashion world, where very much of the products that they're selling are made in other countries, they have to think about this all the time. And if there is a tax, it's going to cost more to produce these things, whether it's clothing, whether it's a part for an automobile, whether it's the entire car itself. While some are rethinking where they're building factories or how they're building out their network, others are just going to simply pass that extra cost on to the consumer. So we may all feel it in the future. So not only will it become more expensive to build a car, but because it could take 10 years to divest from a particular country and either retool or build a brand new plant within, say, the borders of the United States, and then find the suppliers that are either in companies where we have trade deals or that are sourcing and creating their parts within the same country, then all of this will take some time, and ultimately we're all going to feel it.
Yeah, I'd agree. I don't know that they're going to make cars cheaper and make products cheaper. You have an interesting point about parts and within parts. So, like, yeah, you can do with a shirt. So, like, a shirt will have, like, buttons, or they'll have the material to build to make the shirt, and another shirt actually produced. And so you could have three different parts going across different borders, going back and forth. It happens a lot in automotive. Engines are, in many of these cases, transmissions as well. They got to be shipped back and forth, different parts and things. It's a very interesting topic. And I wanted to ask one more question of you, because I think this is really interesting. We were talking a little bit offline about shoes. And I want to – you're talking about mass customization of like Adidas pair of shoes. And this is a fun thing. So you're saying that with a shoe, you could have a customer – order it by color, details, logos, names, and everything. That's kind of what we're talking about. And so you could have your own truck in some instance of this with your name on the dash, like NASCAR style. We could get to this point in the supply chain to get that to that level?
Yeah, I think that the types of customization that we're starting to see as consumers are really only scratching the surface of what can be accomplished down the road. And the shoe example is a great one right now, where say you want a pair of Adidas, Nike does this too. Both of them have programs where you as the customer can go online, you can pick the colors, the materials, you could print your name or your number, your jersey number on the shoe, and have it made for you and sent to you wherever you are. Now, everyone will pay a little bit of a premium for this, but when it comes down to having a shoe that you feel is made for you, that makes a big difference to a lot of customers out there. And the way that, say, an Adidas is manufacturing it, all of these shoes are built off platforms, right? So you're still buying, say, a pair of Stan Smiths, but you might be buying it in blue instead of white, and you might have a sole that's brown instead of, you know, green. This is a weird-looking shoe, I guess. But it's your shoe. Now, Adidas, it would be very hard for them to produce that shoe in a vacuum. So what they're using technology to do now is to build that on its assembly line, along with all the other Stan Smiths. But as it's being produced, that order is tracked all the way back to your name, you the customer. And at every stage of the way, you know, this is Tim's shoe. And it's going to be that weird shoe with it's brown and blue and has pink laces, whatever you might want. But it feels like it's yours. And they make sure that that is tracked and created and then sent to you, as if it was something that was made just for you. Now, in the future, that's going to change even more as we start to get into things like 3D printing. Not only will the shoe be made in your specifications as far as colors and materials, but they might also be able to mold the sole to your exact feet. Say you wear a 9.5 on one foot and a 10 on the other. They'll be able to produce that distinct pair of shoes and, you know, at the right width and everything else so that it is made for you. And I think that with other industries, and automotive is another example, we're heading in that direction a little bit more. Ford really revitalized itself several years ago when they launched the Ford Focus. It had a lot of options, but a lot of those were mass customized options, and you know, any number of cars will. If you look at a Mercedes, almost every one of those cars is made for the customer, using parts that are within their supply chain, but built to a certain specification. Where it's going next, at the high end, you're going to start seeing it first. So a good example is with, say, slipping my mind. But let's say a premium Italian sports car maker that sells vehicles for $500,000 or more. Yeah, like, you know, the cost of a house. If you're investing in that, I don't care how rich you are, you want that car to be made for you. What they're starting to do and what you're going to start seeing is a very high-touch way of not only selecting that car and choosing the parts that go into it, but really customizing every bit and piece of it and being able to watch it get produced along the way. Now, not everyone is buying a $500,000 car, but as it applies to the mass market of vehicles, we're starting to move into a direction where you're not only buying a package of trim levels, say, but you're going to be able to customize a little bit more along the way. The big challenge for automakers throughout that is to make sure that they have a network of a supply base that can get the right parts into the factory and that can ensure that all of these things are being made efficiently and in a timely way, and that that order is tied to the person at the end. So availability and what day it's going to arrive at the dealer, because that's really special. I think that really changes and makes that experience so much more than what car dealerships offer today, which is you go into a dealership so often, they've got X number of this model on the floor, and those are the ones they're going to try to sell you. Maybe they'll give you a deal because this one doesn't have exactly the color of paint that you want. And sometimes you just have to live with it, or you have to go to the aftermarket and have those little modifications done some point after you purchase it at extra cost to you. If we can reduce that friction, and I think that car dealers and car manufacturers in particular want to be able to do that and ensure that the cars that they're making are tied to a person that is motivated to buy it, that is really looking forward to being able to drive a car that they felt that they had a part in creating, and that is their vehicle, not anyone else's. It's going to change the way that we think about brand loyalty in the future. And it's really going to change the user experience, which really at the end of the day matters to those of us who drive all the time. I hope that answers your question.
It does. I can't wait to have my name stamped on the dash of my next truck. I think it's going to be fantastic. I think the customization, that's at next level. It's going to be interesting to see how it turns out. So, hey, thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks, Tim. It was great to be here.
And we had a little bit of audio issues, but that's because he's way out there in the East Coast of, like, New York someplace, and it'll be fine. You check it out. So, and we'll be back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk.
And we're back with more Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. We're doing the final segment on the Dodge Durango. I want to talk about this a little bit with Jill, because it's a great conversation piece. I got it delivered the other day, so I'm not going to do driving impressions, although I've driven the 15, 16, and all the 17 versions, and I don't think they've changed anything besides maybe some technology differences. But I want to talk about this because it's a Durango, when we know Durango is a large SUV, but it's a Citadel version, and the Citadel version in an anodized platinum, I mean, it just looks fantastic. And it's got a price point of $53,560, and I'm bringing that up as well because FCA does not have a luxury brand. They don't. Fiat may be, I don't know what they're doing with all this kind of brands, but they don't have like a true luxury brand. They don't have a Lincoln, a Cadillac. They just don't have it. But the Durango Citadel only, not the RT and not the standard Durango. This really is a luxury SUV. I've driven plenty of them. It has the leather interior. It's got all the fancy features. It's got all the third row. It's got premium entertainment group. I mean, this thing is fully loaded at $53,560. And what I want to ask Jill about is I want to get her thoughts on FCA luxury brands. You know, it seems like a missing piece for them, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, for a while they were trying to make Chrysler, I think, the luxury brand. But that's kind of failed miserably because they have like two cars in their lineup now, yeah, from the Chrysler Pacifica and the Chrysler 300. You know, and for a while there, they were really trying to make that Chrysler 300 like a competitor to something, you know, from the Cadillac brand. At least you know, in my head. And I think you're right. I really think that they are missing an opportunity. I mean, General Motors has two luxury brands, and they can't figure out what to do with them. But
FCA should just buy Buick and make it a luxury brand.
Exactly. But no, I mean, I think Chrysler needs some help. You know, the Chrysler brand itself needs some help, and I think that there could be the opportunity to get into the luxury brand. Because, I mean, Chrysler does a lot of nice stuff on the two vehicles that they now have.
Yeah, right.
Two vehicles.
And it's kind of ridiculous to think that they just have the two cars. Dodge has pulled out of cars. All they have is SUVs and muscle cars. They don't have the entry-level cars. Right. But I do think this brings us another point of the off-and-on-again merger that FCA has talked about for years.
Yeah.
About merging with another company. And you know, it seems like luxury would be something they would add, but I don't know of a single luxury manufacturer on their own. Most luxury manufacturers are owned by somebody else. So I wonder if as the economy has grown if the Dodge Durango Citadel, I think it'd be like a perfect luxury edition. And I think that FCA could do some big numbers in luxury, because they, I don't know about you, but when I look at all the brands, I feel like the designers at FCA do an incredible job with the products they have. They're some of the best looking cars and trucks in the marketplace. And so I would imagine they could do a luxury one that would look really good as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things I think Chrysler does well, or I guess I should call them Chrysler, FCA does well, is they have their vehicles do what they're supposed to do, if that makes sense. They don't muddy up the waters too much. You know, with Chrysler, that's a passenger car brand.
Right.
You know, Dodge is more of like the rugged performance brand. You know, then you have Alfa Romeo, which is kind of like the sporty brand. And then you have Fiat, which is like the cute, compact brand. And so they've done very good. Good grief. What day is today? They've done very well with trying not to be everything to everyone. Which I feel like some of the other manufacturers out there are like, what? You've got an SUV? Well, we'll have an SUV. What? You have a luxury car? Well, we'll have a luxury car. What? You have a sporty car? We'll have a sporty car, all in one brand. And so, but you're right. They are absolutely missing that luxury piece.
Yeah. And you get Hyundai that broke off of Genesis. Mm-hmm. You get, right now there's an Accord event, or not Accord, but there's an Acura event going on. Acura still, you know, pushing out cars with Honda there. Mm-hmm. Lexus has done a pretty incredible job the last couple of years of improving their products, and their sales have come in pretty well. Lexus quality, I mean, it's tough to beat Lexus quality. So I don't know, it just every time I think about the Dodge Durango now, and I've driven, like I said, I've driven them every year the last 3 years, and I got to tell you, I'm a big fan when I get it, because it's just so comfortable and so fun to drive. And with three rows, both in DVD players, it's a great vehicle for family. I just always think that they should have a luxury brand. And so I'll have more on a Dodge Durango next week. I'll have some driving impressions. It's got the 3.6 liter V6 in it with the 8-speed transmission. I can just tell you it's buttery smooth. I've driven it around town for a little bit. I haven't taken any trips with that. So something to look forward to. I also want to throw out a shot about next week's show. Next week's show is going to be, I think I'm going to call it the Rogue Takeover. I think that's my terminology for next week's show. Jill going and I,
rogue? You're going rogue is what you're doing?
Oh, yes, going rogue. I'm trying to, I got to get all my terminology, all my Star Wars terminology and stuff and lined up there. Jill and I are going to Nashville next week. Jill's going to go on a separate flight than I am. We're doing two different waves. We're going to both drive the new Nissan Rogue Sport, which is their entry-level SUV. I do want to say something about Nissan Rogue to preface that as well. Also is that it is the best-selling Nissan vehicle. It's right there, and it's climbing the ranks. I want to see what the sales are, but I believe it's the best-selling non-truck in the country.
I think you're right, actually.
I think I heard that, and so we're going to talk a lot about the Rogue. We have a new contributor, Jasmine Cosme, who took a Rogue trip to New York and won some money for breast cancer research. I'm going to hope to get her on the show next week, talk about her impressions of the Rogue. So it's gonna be lots of Rogue all day, every day, and next week's podcast will just be Rogue. So it's gonna be Rogue-tastic. Ooh, there's another one for you. All right, so check us out on Facebook at Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk on Facebook. Check us out online at pickuptrucktalk.com. check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Send an email at Tim at pickuptrucktalk.com. Check out our sponsor, hdiextra.com. You've probably fast-forwarded through all this information, but that's okay. Check it out. And subscribe to us on iTunes. They're changing iTunes. We're going to be Apple Tunes now. They're changing up the terminology of it. It's Apple Tunes. I don't know why. It's Apple. They do those things. So, hey, check us out, and we'll see you down the road.